This is episode 16 of Books and Ideas, and I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. Today's episode is an interview with Dr. Stephen Novella of the popular podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I want to welcome any new listeners to my podcast, and I want to give a special welcome to those of you from The Skeptic's Guide. To learn more about the Books and Ideas podcast, please go to the website at booksandideas.com. You can also send me email at docartemus@gmail.com. After the interview, I will be back for a closing segment. In that segment, I'll take a look back at the first year of the Books and Ideas podcast and tell you what to expect in the coming year. Let's get on in to Dr. Novella's interview. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Novella, who many of you have asked me to have on the show. So, Steve, thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure, Ginger. Thanks for having me.
Before we start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, especially your personal background? And I'm interested in why you chose to go into medicine.
Well, I am a clinical physician. I'm a neurologist with an N, so I often have to clarify that. And I did my medical school training at Georgetown and then my neurology training at Yale. And I stayed at Yale after my training. I'm there as a full-time faculty member. So I'm in what they call the clinical educator tract, which is an academic tract that involves primarily seeing patients and teaching in the context of seeing patients. That's most of what I do. And then I'm about 10% clinical research as well. That's my day job. That's my primary career.
Did you want to be a doctor from the time you were a little boy? Or
no, I think I entertained various career ideas. When I was growing up, I thought about being a lawyer for a while. And then by the time I went to college, I knew I wanted to go into a science background. And I did pre-med in undergraduate school. So certainly by then I had decided that that's probably what I wanted to do. So, you know, I think I would probably say in my late teens is when I really decided to go into medicine, which I always, looking back, I find it interesting because I honestly had absolutely no idea what clinical medicine was like at the time that I made that decision. But I really fell in love with clinical medicine in medical school, which I consider just to be lucky, really, more than anything else.
Yeah, because I think I hated it in medical school and didn't actually develop any attraction to it till I did an internship at a small hospital where the medicine was more bread and butter.
Right. I mean, the good thing about medicine is that even late in the game, there's lots of career paths open to you. Even after your residency, after you're basically done with your training, you could decide to be basically clinical or to do mainly research or to even go into industry or to do public health. When you choose your subspecialty, you could, you know, have there's patient-oriented and non-patient-oriented subspecialties. So there are a lot of career paths that you could choose. And I do find that most people sort themselves into where their strengths are. And you know, for me, it was clinical medicine, diagnosing patients. You know, that's what captured my attention the most.
Did you decide you wanted to be a neurologist early on?
Yeah, I did. I liked pretty much everything in medicine when we were doing, you know, the third year rotations, you get a taste of everything. I can't say that there was any rotation I didn't like. I pretty much enjoyed all of clinical medicine. But early on, neurology was on the radar. And then when I did my first clinical neurology rotation in the third year of medical school, I was absolutely sold. That my decision was obvious to me at that point in time. It was far and away the most interesting, fascinating, you know, rotation that I had done. Just the patients, the diseases, just thinking about how the nervous system works. Again, I fell in love with it, and it was an easy decision for me at that point.
You liked the kind of Sherlock Holmes aspect of trying to figure out, because that was before everybody was doing everything with CT scans. You actually had to do some thinking to figure out the diagnosis, right?
Well, not in my time. I mean, I don't know how old you think I am, but I mean, actually, I think that's a bit of a misconception, and I was told that in medical school too, that back in the day, before all the fancy technological diagnostic equipment, before MRIs and CAT scans, neurologists had to be excellent clinicians and really think about things. But I find that that's actually not true, that modern neurologists, of course, you can be lazy and you could overly rely upon technology and upon diagnostic tests to give you the answer. But if you are a thoughtful clinician, I think that clinicians today are far better than the clinicians of the pre-technological clinicians, because if you, you know, saw a patient with a deficit 50 years ago, you could make your pronouncements as a neurologist about what part of the brain isn't working and what it all means. And unless the patient died and had an autopsy sometime soon, you never really found out if you were right or you were wrong. Your word was just the final authority and that was it. But today, I see a patient, I say, I think this is where the lesion is and this is why I think it's there. Then we get an MRI scan and I find out within hours if I was right or not. And that process makes you, you know, very good at thinking about the brain and thinking about lesions and localizing. And I always tell my residents, you got to play this game. You got to localize the lesion before you look at the imaging. You can't retrodict. You got to predict where the lesion's going to be. That way, you will get very good very quickly at understanding how, you know, different brain lesions, how different, you know, damage in different parts of the brain results in the clinical picture that you see, the exam and the symptoms that you see.
Well, that's a good point. I had never thought of it from that point of view. So how long have you been practicing neurology?
After my training, I think this is the 11th year at Yale practicing neurology.
Okay, so you really did come along when the scanning was already. I graduated from medical school in 1984, so CT scans were just new. And if someone came in with a stroke and you wanted to do a scan, we actually had to call the radiologist in, which, of course, you know, radiologists never like to come in. It was a really big deal. It was back in one of the many incarnations of whether or not to give heparin to people with strokes. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm an ER doctor, I can't keep track of how often they change their mind about what they think about that.
Yeah, that's an enduring controversy, you know, using heparin and other anticoagulants for strokes, because, as you know, it's the benefit versus the risk is really close to the line. So there just isn't a definitive answer.
That's even more true for TPA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, TPA, at least there's some hard and fast criteria now for TPA. For heparin, we never even got to the point where we could say, here's the protocol. If you stay on this protocol, you're more likely to help than to hurt. It's still just, it's right on the line, and therefore it's pretty much up to opinion, which is overly affected by authority, how you were taught, and also just by your quirky personal experience.
Yeah, that's very true that doctors are affected by their... We're probably more affected by our personal experience with patients than people like to admit.
Even that we like to admit.
Well, that's especially we, probably.
Right.
So during your career, what do you think is the most important discovery or change that you've seen?
You know, I don't think there's any one huge thing. I think all of the fundamental big discoveries were laid down before I started. And I graduated in 1991, so just a little bit less than a decade after you. I think that, you know, the science progresses by baby steps these days. And we take every little incremental improvement is a big deal. You know, but there's no huge discoveries that change our very approach to things. I would say that when I started doing medicine in the early 90s, MRI, CT scans were well established, and the MRI scans were really just coming on the scene. And that the MRI technology, magnetic resonance imaging, has really improved incredibly over the last 10 years. And all kinds of new types of MRI scans, you know, they can process that information many, many different ways. So that has been the most consistently advancing and changing aspect, I think, of neurological practice.
And you're not really involved very much in the basic research of neurology since you're a clinician.
Yeah, I don't do basic research. I do clinical research. So I do clinical trials, usually one arm of a multi-center trial. Do some investigator-initiated research with some colleagues of mine in my department, in my subspecialty of neuromuscular disease. So we've done some diabetic neuropathy research, and now I'm collaborating with my chairman and some others on a rare disease called erythromelalgia, which is a very fascinating disease that causes terrible burning neuropathic pain, which has no cure and really no very effective treatment right now. So it's good in that it's an interesting disease. We're learning a lot about it. And it's also very rare, which means there isn't a lot of other people around the world who are dealing with that. So, you know, it's good to have something about which, you know, you could know more than everybody else. So that's my research always has that clinical angle to it, though.
Yeah. You know, I've been doing the brain science podcast. I'm not a neurologist or a neuroscience per se. I mean, I did graduate school in biomedical engineering and worked with some people doing neuroscience research, but that was a long time ago. I'm doing this podcast because I have a personal interest in the subject, and I'm just trying to put it out in plain English to other non-specialists. And in the last year, the thing that has been the most interesting to me that I've been reading a lot about is neuroplasticity. Have you noticed any impact of the implications of neuroplasticity in your work yet?
Not yet. I think neuroplasticity is the notion that the brain can rewire itself and generate new neurons in response to injury or in response to need. And what we've discovered in the last 5 to 10 years that there is much more plasticity in the adult brain than we had previously thought. In fact, we've discovered that there are neurological stem cells in the brain that will actually make new connections and grow new neurons in response to new demands being put upon the brain. That's all been extremely interesting. It hasn't filtered yet through from our basic science understanding of plasticity necessarily to changing the way we practice medicine, because we've always, you know, at least in modern times, we've known that there was some degree of plasticity, and we've always tried to get the most out of it. So we're treating patients on the assumption that they had some ability to improve after damage, you know, doing rehab and et cetera. So our knowledge of plasticity hasn't translated into changing how we actually treat patients. It's just really expanded our understanding of it. I think that it may potentially lead to that. And I think that, in fact, a lot of the stem cell research is now heading in that direction, trying to actually, you know, regenerate damaged parts of the brain, you know, after an injury, rather than just, you know, making the most of what's there. So I think that probably the benefit of that line of research we have yet to see, and that'll probably be coming in over the next 10 or 20 years.
When I use the term neuroplasticity, I'm not referring to just growing new neurons. I'm also referring to the discoveries that there are some connections that are probably, I don't know if I should use the word latent, but ones that don't get used because competitively they're other connections are being used. For example, the discovery that the visual cortex can do other things when there's no visual input.
Mm-hmm.
So in that line, for example, I mentioned in the notes I sent to you, constraint-induced movement therapy, which is really not based on the idea that any new neurons are going to grow. It's based on the idea that there are connections that can be unmasked and strengthened.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely unused neurons. Yeah, I don't want to inadvertently feed into the myth that we only use 10% of our brain. I'm sure you,
yeah,
you
let's
know.
Let's definitely let's say that's, that false. Not, that's false. That's
false. Yeah, we use all of our brain, but there are neurons that are either underutilized or waiting to be utilized even in the adult brain. And in fact, once we get past around 50, there's a process called pruning by which neurons that are not actively being used start to die off and the brain will atrophy. And that doesn't necessarily result in any decreased cognitive ability, but it does result in a decreased adaptability. So, which makes sense. There's fewer neurons waiting around to be recruited to new tasks. I also found it interesting that the research, in the last decade or so, has shown that by introducing novelty, continuing to learn new types of cognitive skills, especially after the age of 50, really delays that whole process and keeps those neurons around longer. In essence, maintains our neuroplasticity as we age. So perhaps one of the healthiest things that we could do for ourselves neurologically is just to remain really mentally active, especially as we get older, not to fall into the trap of, you know, doing the same old routine or continuing the hobbies that you've always done. You should make it a point to learn something that's completely different than what you've done before in your life, and that's very, very healthy for the brain.
Yeah, that's one of the themes that's really come out of almost everyone that I've talked to about this. It seems
one
like
one example, if I may, is actually video games, which I found to be very funny. Since, you know, I'm a big video game aficionado. Started playing when I was a young kid, and I've always had a fascination with them. And all of the research on video games shows that it's incredibly a positive effect. I mean, people, I think a lot of people have negative assumptions that if you're, you know, sitting in front of a computer screen playing a game, that your mind is wasting away. In fact, the evidence shows that it makes people more intelligent, and not just in the ways that you would think. For example, eye-hand coordination. Actually, it improves cognitive ability beyond that. And that dovetails with the neuroplasticity research that I was just talking about, in that the thing that makes video games interesting is that they're introducing novel cognitive tasks, and the difficulty of them, they're usually designed so that the difficulty is always one step out of reach from where you are. And then when you master that level, you progress to the next level where things are a little bit harder still. And that's that's actually turns out to be the optimal way to stimulate, you know, the brain to be healthy and to maintain its plasticity.
Well, I guess then I can be take a positive attitude to the fact that since my husband's retired, he has beat Halo 3 three times, and he's working on the fourth time. He's on Heroic right now. And I still haven't had time to play it once.
Yeah, you got everything in moderation, but it is actually overall a positive thing to do.
My video gaming has been the thing that disappeared when I took up podcasting.
Yes. It definitely eats into pretty much all other aspects of my life, including video gaming.
I still make time for playing tennis, though. I wanted to ask you about your experience, since I know you probably get a lot of emails and stuff, with magazines like Scientific American Mind becoming popular. Do you think your patients getting any more aware of how their brains work?
Well, I definitely notice that my patients have more information. I don't necessarily think that that information is better. I think it's very hit or miss. So patients are coming to me with more misinformation in addition to more information. And they often, in fact, will come to me with a ream of paper that they've printed off of the internet. And then we'll go through it together. If it's off of a reputable site, sometimes it's all very useful information, but oftentimes it's just chock full of nonsense. And then I have to spend time deconstructing it for them and showing them, explaining to them why all of this is not accepted, you know, scientific information. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword, and I think it informs my sort of clinical philosophy, in that I spend a lot of time educating patients about their brain and their disease, and I think that that's a necessity these days. It certainly correlates with more compliance. Patients are much more likely to do what you think that they should do if they understand why you think they should do that. You can also successfully steer them away from misinformation by educating them about, you know, how we know what's real and what isn't real, and how we make our recommendations. Sometimes, in fact, you know, being at an academic center, I get referrals from other neurologists, or patients will come to me for a second opinion. And oftentimes, I completely agree with the opinion of the first neurologist. They just didn't spend 10 minutes with the patient explaining to them their opinion. That's the only thing that I add to the patient care, is that I spend 10 minutes teaching the patient about why what the first guy said actually was correct.
Yeah, ironically, now so many doctors don't really have, or they don't make enough time. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. Enough time with their patients. I work in a small emergency room, and sometimes I tell my patients this ironic truth that one reason I'm in the emergency room instead of private practice is that I can spend more time with patients in the emergency room than I would be able to if I was in an office.
Right.
And the patients will say, well, that's the first time anyone's ever explained that to me.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I often get that response as well. Yeah, I think that, you know, the reality of managed care is that insurance companies are only paying for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And in order for physicians in private practice to survive, that's all they could really spend with a patient in a return visit. So I think if we want that to change, you know, we have to change the system a little bit, you know.
As a primary care physician, I found it very frustrating that the insurance companies would pay over $1,000 for an MRI, but wouldn't pay for the doctor to spend more than 10 minutes with the patient figuring out that they've actually had headaches for 50 years and don't need an MRI.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that it's actually even made the system more efficient. It's always penny wise and a dollar foolish. They cut costs where they can easily, logistically, which is just saying, all right, we're going to pay you less for seeing patients, forcing doctors to see more patients and therefore spend less time with them. and not realizing that that results in probably more unnecessary studies, maybe more delayed definitive diagnosis, patients seeking second opinions when they didn't really need the second opinion. So I don't think it's actually increased the efficiency of healthcare at all. It's just sucked a lot of resources out of it.
So let's sort of change gears now. And one last neurological thing I wanted to talk to you about was your main area is neuromuscular diseases.
That's correct. So neuromuscular diseases, which includes diseases of the nerves, the muscles, the neuromuscular junction, the connection between the two, and the motor neurons, which would be in the brain and spinal cord.
Do you see many patients that have diseases that are related to aging?
Yes. You know, there is a neuropathy of aging. So, you know, we do see nerve damage that is either just a course of aging or is exacerbated by that. And most of the other neuromuscular diseases that I see, either they're genetic or they're neurodegenerative. They have increased risk with age, but they're not necessarily a disease of age.
The question I wanted to ask you is, and this kind of relates to the kind of information people get off the internet, because a lot of it, I think, is put out there by people trying to sell things, like pharmacological companies trying to convince people that drugs, for instance, like the ones for Alzheimer's disease, are really helpful when it seems like there's not evidence that they do very much of anything. And I just kind of have this gut feeling that a lot of people are putting too much hope into drug solutions. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, pharmacotherapy is overall a very successful approach, but you have to do what we call rational pharmacotherapy. We definitely need to be as skeptical as anything of claims being made by the proponents of whatever product they're selling. Certainly the pharmaceutical industry always tries to put their best foot forward and tries to spin the evidence. Sometimes I absolutely reject their spin. I mean, they're trying to like really either split hairs or even misinterpret, you know, the research or try to somehow massage the data so that they get a statistical significance when there really isn't any clinically significant advantage to their drug, or they'll focus on some distinction which, you know, doesn't, you know, really matter that much in the big picture clinically. But and the same is true of the supplement industry. I think a lot of times people, you know, because big pharma is like the big bad guys on the block, they the supplement industry gets a free pass, and I think that's a mistake. In fact, you know, also the pharmaceutical industry and the supplement industry are very much merging. There's a tremendous amount of overlap. I think, if anything, the problem is a lot worse in the supplement industry because it's essentially deregulated. So manufacturers can make pretty much whatever claims that they want, as long as they're a little bit careful in the wording, not to mention specific diseases, then they could make, in essence, almost any healthcare claims. So I think the public needs to be, you know, extremely cautious and extremely skeptical about all of that. And I think, you know, again, the same approach needs to be applied to claims that are not, you know, pharmacologically based. So, you know, if you're saying that physical therapy helps with a problem, that's just as much of a healthcare claim as saying that a medication helps with a problem. You know, I believe in science-based, evidence-based medicine, and I think that should apply to any claim, regardless of what the basis is.
But it seems like the average person doesn't really understand concepts of statistical significance. So it's real easy for a benefit that's really not significant to be sold to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of complexity in interpreting the scientific data. Pretty much every kind of mistake that you could make, the public is encouraged to make by clever advertising. For example, I often will see basic science research used to support clinical claims. And as we know, you can't do that. You know, you can't take the effect of something, whatever it is, on cells in a petri dish or on animals or whatever, and apply that to a net clinical outcome in a person. So that's one big mistake I often see. And especially in the supplement industry, again, because they're not required to do human research, so often they'll just pull some paper that says, you know, whatever this substance, this herb or vitamin or mineral or whatever has this, you know, effect on cells, then they will base a marketing campaign around that, claiming that it, you know, for example, will boost the immune system and therefore people are taking it for their cancer. I mean, there's no limit to where they'll extrapolate from that. I think that's probably the single biggest problem. There are more subtle things like in terms of like interpreting statistics. For example, people often don't understand the difference between absolute risk and relative risk. So for example, if there's a 1 in a million chance of getting a disease and you reduce that to, you know, a half a per million or 1 per 2 million, that's a 50% reduction in the relative risk. And that could make it seem like a huge deal. In fact, the absolute risk is insignificant.
That's how I felt about the whole decision making with Biox. I mean, it's like, okay, you have a 1 in a million risk of getting heart disease, and now you're going to have a 2 in a million, which doubles the risk. So this is a big deal. We must take it off the market. I mean, as a person who I have an artificial hip and I've taken a lot of anti-inflammatories over the years, right. I resented the idea that I wasn't going to be able to make that decision with my doctor. Mm-hmm. Rather than have, you know, some lawyers are worrying about being sued, basically right. driving the decision.
Right. And interestingly, it's the situation with Celebrex, which is related to Vioxx, is almost the same thing in terms of the data. It's not quite as bad as the Vioxx data. And that's what they did do. They said, all right, there is this concern, but, you know, you could make this a risk versus benefit assessment between the doctor and the patient. And I agree that maybe that would have been the better approach to Vioxx. Although, you know, Merck voluntarily pulled it off the market. They weren't required to. And I think they did it because of the fear of liability and litigation, probably because when they looked at it, they said, oh, gee, you know what? We've been sitting on this data for a few years. It really looks bad. We better just like now really be proactive and pull it off the market. That's what I suspect happened. But you're right. It's not like people were dropping dead like flies because they were taking Vioxx. I think that the risk was hugely overblown.
In fact, if I had known it was about to come off the market, I would have bought up a bunch of it.
Yeah.
Before we close, I know that many of my listeners are already fans of your podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. But for those of them who haven't heard it, do you want to talk a little bit about your podcast?
Yeah, sure. This is a weekly science podcast. It usually runs about 70 to 80 minutes in length. It has multiple different segments to it. We often will do some science news. We'll answer emails. Most of the time we interview guests. We have some fun sections like science or fiction where we challenge the audience to pick out the fake science news items from the real science news items. And we deal primarily with controversial topics or topics on the fringe of science. So sometimes we do just straight up really interesting science news stories, whatever captures our interest. But we deal with the paranormal or conspiracy theories or health fraud, consumer protection type of issues. And our goal is to give our listeners the tools to look at science in the news, science in society, and, you know, have some way of navigating through all of the claims and all of the hype and, you know, basically have the tools to figure things out for themselves, you know, more than anything else.
And how can they find you if they want to learn more?
We are on iTunes. I'm happy to say that we've been, for the last couple of years, we've been in the top 20 of all science podcasts in iTunes, and we're in the top, you know, 5 or 6, usually either 1, 2, or 3 in terms of the newest downloaded or the most popular podcast. So you'll see The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe on the science and medicine section of iTunes. You can also go directly to our website and download individual episodes directly from our website, or find places to sign up for the RSS. So we do have an RSS feed that you can subscribe to.
Is your address one that's easy for somebody to get?
Yeah, it's theskepticsguide.org.
Okay. I'll put a link in the show notes, but some people, in fact, most people never go to the show notes, as I'm sure you
right.
know. So.
That's right.
Yeah. So how do you manage to put out a long podcast every week? You have other people working on it with you.
Yeah, I have 4 co-hosts who do share in the prep work. You know, often I try to get everybody to like at least prep, you know, 1, if not 2 items to talk about during the show. And one of the co-hosts also runs the website. And so, you know, we try to divide the work as much as possible. But I produce the show, so I'm ultimately responsible for the content and prepping it. And I do all the post-production, which I know, as you know, is a lot of work. So, you know, it's a good 20, 30 hours a week that I put into putting out this podcast. It's almost like having a second job. And it's, you know, it's a labor of love. It's certainly not easy. It's a lot of work every week. But what we found out with these kind of things is that you can't just do it every now and then. Like, if you really want to build an audience and build a brand and stay popular, you have to put out content on a regular basis. So we committed ourselves to putting out a show a week, and we've been able to do that, you know, for over 100 episodes.
That's great. I think I probably put 20 to 30 hours a week into the Brain Science podcast, but I, I'm only able to get it out every other week. But I work really hard to do that for the exact reason that you said, which is they have to know your content's going to be there regularly.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, we have a great audience. We have a very active fan base. We have an active, you know, fan website, sgufans.net. The SGU forums are extremely active community. But by the same token, our fans are very demanding. They always want a lot, and they want more from us. And, you know, we're happy to deliver that content, but that's the nature of the relationship.
So before we close, is there anything else that you would like to say or share? Usually I'm interviewing book authors, and I always like to try to give them a chance to talk about what I forgot to ask them, but that may not, right. That might not apply to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, at the moment, I don't have any books to plug, although I do have a few irons in the fire, as they say. Like, I'm working on a few things. I do have my blog, which your listeners may be interested in, Neurologica blog. Monday through Friday, so I pretty much stick to that. Occasionally, if I'm really, really busy on a day, I'll miss an entry. But so 4 or 5 entries per week on topics of science and medicine, neuroscience, logic and philosophy, to skepticism in general. I'll probably be putting some of that content into book format, hopefully over the next year. And then the Skeptics Guide also has a blog attached to that, the SGU blog, which is the Rogues Gallery. And I'm also in the process of starting up a third blog, which is going to, you know, keep me busy. But this is one that is going to focus on science and medicine. And the name of the blog is Science-Based Medicine. This should be coming out by the beginning of 2008 is my goal. And for this one, I'm putting together many, many authors. So this is not going to be one that I'm going to be authoring personally. I'm going to be contributing to it, I'm trying to put together a dozen or so people who are experienced writers explaining medicine to the public and confronting health fraud or controversial topics in medicine. This is all based around the concept that medicine should be and is best when it is based upon the best science.
That sounds really good. You're going to have to be sure to let me know when that goes online so I can put a link to it on my websites.
Absolutely. We'll be announcing it as soon as I've pressured my web developers into actually doing all the busy work and getting it online. But it should be very soon.
Well, great. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
It was my pleasure, Ginger. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate Dr. Novella taking time to be on the Books and Ideas podcast. If you visit the website booksandideas.com, you'll find the show notes, including links to Dr. Novella's blogs. You can leave comments at the website booksandideas.com or send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. If you downloaded this episode because you're a fan of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, I hope you will check out my other podcast, The Brain Science Podcast. On The Brain Science Podcast, we explore how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mysteries of how our brains make us who we are. The website is brainsciencepodcast.com. We also have a discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. The forum has a special section for the Books and Ideas podcast, and that's a great place to leave feedback. Both of my podcasts, Books and Ideas and the Brain Science Podcast, are available on iTunes. The easiest way to find them there is to go into the iTunes Music Store and search under Ginger Campbell.